Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Alabama Medicaid Work Requirement Press Call. Currently, all phone lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, there'll be an opportunity to ask questions during a question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Please be advised today's program may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce Kathy Hope at Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. You may begin.
Thank you, Aaron. This is Kathy Hope. I'm the Communications Director here at Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, and want to thank you all for joining us. Before we get started, I just want to mention that our thoughts are with everyone impacted by the tornadoes and severe weather in Alabama. And I am joined here today by Joan Elker, who is the Executive Director here at the center. And also joined by Jim Carnes, the Policy Director of Alabama ARISE Citizens Policy Project, and Dr. Marsha Rollerson, a pediatrician from rural Brewton, Alabama. And we're going to release a report today. It is on the Medicaid work requirement that has been proposed in Alabama. And Joan Elker is going to first start us off by giving us the top findings from the report and putting it within the context of the national scene on Medicaid waivers. Joan?
Thanks, Kathy. So this is Joan Elker, and I'm a research professor here at the Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy and also the executive director of the Center for Children and Families. Before I turn to the findings of the report that we're releasing today about Alabama, I'm going to just briefly talk about the national context on these Medicaid Section 1115 waivers. On January 11th of this year, federal CMS released guidance announcing its interest in approving state proposals to impose a work requirement on Medicaid beneficiaries. Since then, CMS has approved three waivers to do so. These waivers have other important and harmful changes, such as lockouts, which we're not talking about today. But those three states with a work requirement that CMS has approved are Kentucky, Indiana, and Arkansas. It's worth noting that all three of these states, though, have accepted the Affordable Care Act Medicaid funding to expand their program to adults below 138% of the federal poverty line. Federal CMS has yet to respond to a request to impose a work requirement from a state like Alabama that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And that's really what we're here to discuss today. In states that have not expanded Medicaid, these proposals will negatively impact families with children only. And these families with children are some of the most vulnerable in the country with extremely low incomes. A few other states have similar requests pending, most notably Mississippi, but also Kansas and Maine. Though for a variety of reasons, Kansas and Maine, their waivers may not move forward in their current form. So Alabama and Mississippi are really the states to watch on this issue, in my view. As we speak, Alabama's proposal is currently up for public comment at the state level until April 2nd. Mississippi's has already been submitted to the federal government. As such, the federal government could render a decision on this issue at any time. So let's turn now to Alabama's proposal. Alabama seeks to do two things. First, to impose a work or community service requirement on parents with incomes at or below 18% of the federal poverty line. We're talking here about families whose income is no more than $312 a month for a family of three. While most expansion states that have done a work requirement include some kind of exemption for parents, Alabama does not and really cannot because it is targeting specifically its work requirement at parents. Parents of children under 6 years old merely have a lower burden of hours, 20 per week, as opposed to parents of older children who must work 35 hours a week. The second part of the proposal seeks to roll back what's called transitional medical assistance, or TMA, benefits from 12 months to 6 months. When you unpack these two pieces of the proposal, it is clear that this is not about encouraging very poor parents to work, nor is it likely to succeed in that regard. The practical effect of Alabama's proposal is quite clearly to take away Medicaid coverage from these very poor parents. This is true for two reasons. Because Alabama's eligibility threshold for parents is so low, the work requirement itself creates a catch-22 where a parent who complies will earn too much to be eligible for Medicaid anymore, and one who doesn't comply will be sanctioned and lose coverage that way. The second part of the proposal, limiting TMA, takes away Medicaid coverage from parents who see their incomes go up because they're working more, the very behavior the proposal says the state wants to encourage. Many, if not most, of these parents who lose Medicaid are likely to become uninsured because the prevalence of employer-sponsored insurance in Alabama for low-wage workers is very low. Less than a quarter of adults in Alabama with earned income below the poverty line have ESI. These realities suggest that Alabama's proposal is not a serious effort to help families get on their feet, but rather an effort to cut enrollment and score some political points. The state's own budget neutrality spreadsheets, when analyzed, suggest a coverage loss of approximately 8,700 parents in the first year alone. So let's talk more about who these families are and what our analysis found. We found they are mostly women, head of households, at least 85%. They're more likely to be African American, 58%. And their rural areas and small towns are will be disproportionately impacted because they have a higher percentage of adults and children on Medicaid than metropolitan areas. The majority of these parents, 60%, are not in the workforce because they are caring for a child or somebody with a disability. Only 24% are unemployed. While Alabama's proposal explicitly states as a goal that it will improve health outcomes for parents and children, I would argue that the opposite is true. Research is clear that being uninsured raises the risk for parents and children to not be able to access the health services they need. I'm going to spend a minute now focusing on the harm to children specifically from this proposal. Children are at risk for three key reasons. As their parents become uninsured, the entire family is at risk for medical debt and even bankruptcy, moving these families in the opposite direction of economic self-sufficiency. Families at this income level are already experiencing very high levels of homelessness and residential instability, as well as higher rates of health problems. Second, a healthier parent is a better parent. For example, Medicaid has been shown clearly to reduce the incidence of depression, and maternal depression is epidemic among very low-income women. This inhibits parent-child bonding in the critical early years of development. And finally, as more parents become uninsured, research is clear that children are more likely to not have coverage as well. An insured parent almost never has an uninsured child, but a parent that doesn't have coverage raises the odds that the child, too, will be uninsured. This is particularly troubling because our analysis found in Alabama these very poor children living at or below 18% of the poverty line already have a significantly higher uninsured rate of 6.2% as compared to the state's overall rate of 2.4% uninsured kids. I'd like to close by highlighting this last point. For many years now, I have called Alabama the Star of the South for its success in covering children. More than 97% of its kids have coverage. This is the best rate of children's coverage in the South and even ranks highly nationwide. This wonderful accomplishment will be at risk if the state's waiver proposal moves forward.
Well, thank you, Joan. And now I'd like to turn it over to Jim Carnes, the policy director of Alabama Arise Citizens Policy Project, who co-released this report with us. Jim?
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you, Joan, for that great overview. As Joan mentioned, in a state with the nation's lowest Medicaid eligibility for parents of dependent children at just 18% of the federal poverty level, Alabama's proposed work requirement creates a catch-22 for people in deep poverty. It's a no-win proposition. People in the targeted group lose coverage if they don't work and if they do work. Right now, a parent working just 10 hours a week at minimum wage earns too much to be eligible for Medicaid in our state. Yet the proposal requires people to work 35 hours a week, or 20 if they're caring for a child under age 6, thereby losing their eligibility. Because Alabama has refused Medicaid expansion, there's little to no coverage available for people who fulfill the work requirement. It makes no sense to make people work to keep health coverage, only to take it away when they do. Under the current rules, extremely low-income parents who receive Medicaid have a protection from sudden loss of coverage if their income rises. When they begin earning too much to qualify for Medicaid, they can get coverage called transitional medical assistance for 12 months while they look for other insurance. We know that the new proposal will expand the number of people using that transitional coverage as they find work. But this same proposal cuts the transition period in half to 6 months, effectively pulling the rug out from under people just as they're getting on their feet. One theory the proposal sets out to prove is that, quote, providing workforce opportunities will result in transition to other health insurance, unquote. But the lack of affordable coverage options, along with the shortened transition period, makes a mockery of that rationale. Two other points I want to highlight quickly are the lack of supports for people who want to transition to work and the impact of the proposal on the state budget. The proposal targets people who are already working at home taking care of children. The plan doesn't address the shortage of affordable child care and public transportation, which many parents would need if they worked outside the home. As of January 2018, there was a waiting list of more than 2,000 children for subsidized child care and significantly more pent-up need. And Alabama has no state-funded public transportation. Local transit options vary widely, with many rural counties lacking dependable service. The proposal also fails to explain how the state will provide adequate job training and search assistance for thousands of people in the targeted group. These concerns raise significant unanswered questions about how Alabama will pay for implementing this proposal. Keeping track of who's working, who's looking, who's not working, and who's exempt is a massive undertaking. If the state expands subsidized child care, as it should, to meet the needs of these newly working mothers, that's another big hit to the state budget. Cost savings appear to be the driving concern of this waiver, which by Medicaid's own projections will cause around 17,000 people to lose their coverage over the life of the waiver. But the proposal does not include total associated costs to the state, which will likely far outweigh any savings from reduced enrollment. And there's a further concern, the considerable cost to the state and to families stemming from the adverse health effects of coverage loss is a sobering subtext of this plan. We call on our state officials to review the stated mission of Medicaid. Congress established Medicaid in 1965 as a federal-state partnership to provide health coverage for low-income and medically needy individuals. Denying health coverage in the name of promoting work is outside the authority of Medicaid and contradicts the program's core purpose. Fortunately, there is a federally required comment period for proposals like this one, and I would urge Alabamians to review the harsh, costly impact of this plan and voice their concerns by email to publiccomment@medicaid.alabama.gov. Thank you, and I'll be happy to take questions at the appropriate time.
Oh, thank you very much, Jim, and we will definitely have a lot of questions at the end, I'm sure. Many of our guests will. But now I really don't need to introduce the next guest to those of you from Alabama because she is a legend, Dr. Marcia Rollerson. She's been serving children in Brewton, Alabama for 37 years, and she's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thank you, Dr. Rollerson, for taking time away from your practice to share with us what the impact of this Medicaid work requirement proposal will be on the children and families that you serve.
Thank you very much. As she said, I'm Marcia Rollerson. I'm a pediatrician in rural Alabama. I've been fortunate to practice in this wonderful state for 37 years. For the first 35 years of my practice, I took care of about 150 children a week. 70 to 80% of them received their health care through Medicaid. For the last year and a half, I have limited my practice in a semi-retirement time to children with special health care needs. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the vulnerable children and families that would be impacted by this waiver. One of the moms in my practice tries very hard to find a job. In fact, in the last 2 years, I know that she has had three different jobs and now is unemployed. We were excited last summer when she told me that she had found a job in a factory in her town, and it was going to have a good wage and possibility for her to have health insurance herself. But they had a requirement that she had to work for 90 days without missing a single day while she was in a transition period into that job. She made it almost to the 90 days. Just before she would have become a full-time employee, one of her children got sick. She couldn't find anyone to take care of the child. The child was rejected from daycare because she had a fever. It was a morning where she suddenly got ill, and the mother could find no other person who could take care of her child. She missed work that day and the next day, and she lost her job. Recently, I saw her again, and she's once again trying to find a job. Mostly, jobs in the rural area are not that easy to find. Often, they are minimum wage jobs. And one of the problems with being a parent and working at one of these low-paying jobs is that often you don't know from one week to the next what your hours will be. So if I say, I need to see your child back in 3 weeks to check that ear infection, and the mother says, well, I don't know what my work requirements are going to be that week. Can I just call you back and let you know? Sometimes they'll get called into work with less than a day's notice. That plays havoc with a mom who's having to pay for child care, trying to arrange transportation for her child when they get off the school bus in the afternoon, and it makes it very difficult for her to keep that job. Another family that I care for that I know would be impacted by this waiver is a young mom with two boys who are both autistic and on the autism spectrum. She has to go to the school from time to time. One of them is in a Head Start program, and the other one is in kindergarten. She often goes to the school to work out plans for her child's needs. She also has to go one day a week, 90 miles, to a center that helps work with her two autistic children on their verbal skills. One of the children doesn't talk at all at this time, but the other one, the older one, who's had opportunities to attend this autism special program, is learning to talk and has gotten so much better over the last year. So one day a week she's traveling 90 miles to get services for her autistic children. Other days she's having to go to the school. I suspect that she might be exempt from the work requirement because of her special needs children. However, the paperwork, the time involved, the trying to follow up on what she's required to do, I think she may very well fall through the cracks and not get the health care that she needs. I can give you another example of how difficult it is for families in Alabama, especially in the rural area, to have their children cared for while they work. We have one of the outstanding K-4 programs in our state. It's a wonderful program. However, it serves only 25% of the 4-year-olds who apply. So 3 out of 4 children are on the waiting list for that program. If a mother is trying to plan a work schedule and her child is on a waiting list for a child care program, a school program, what is she going to do? Although child care in our area is often cheaper than it is in the cities, it's really over $100 a week for one child. A mother working at minimum wage would be spending most of her income paying for child care. And then if the child gets sick, they're not eligible to go that day. And what is she to do about her job? I've been very proud of my state because we have one of the lowest uninsured rates for children in our nation. We've worked so hard over the last 20 years to achieve that goal. However, I do know that children who are most likely not to have an insurance are eligible for Medicaid. But because of the problems with getting registered and the mother not having health care herself, those are the very children who fall through the cracks. Therefore, I urge our state to withdraw this waiver, that the proposed work requirements for Medicaid will lead to more parents and children losing coverage. Their health will be at risk. Alabama's done a lot of things right, but this is just wrong. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rollerson. And now, Erin, if you could let our guests know how they can queue up for a question.
Certainly. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star, then 1 on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, it is star, then 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue.
And while we're queuing up, I thought maybe we could follow up with what Dr. Rollerson just mentioned, that children and families in rural areas will be particularly hard hit by this work requirement. I'm wondering, what about the impact on rural hospitals and rural healthcare providers such as yourself?
Oh, my hospital was just two blocks from my office. We are all very worried right now because for the first time in the history of our rural hospital, we are now in the red, and we don't know what's going to happen. Because Alabama did not expand Medicaid to adults up to over 100% of the poverty level, our hospital cares for a rural population, often who are sicker than people living in cities, often people who have transportation issues. Because of this, our hospital cares for a lot of indigent patients, and we just don't get paid for those services. So we are a lifeline for people living. It's over 90 miles to Mobile and over 50 miles to Pensacola. So we are a hospital that's out there caring for people who might have a sudden stroke, who might have an automobile accident. We're caring for people, and we do take care of them. We have a wonderful emergency room service. We are able to stabilize critically ill patients and transport them to a tertiary care hospital. But what if my hospital can no longer pay its bills? Also, we're the second largest employer in our county. So if our hospital goes under, not only will we not have the care in an emergency, but also several hundred people will be out of jobs.
Okay, thank you for weighing in on that. And it looks like we have some questions in the queue now from some of the reporters on the line. Erin?
Certainly. We can take our first question from Tammy Luby with CNN. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks so much for holding this call. I'm sorry, I dropped twice from the call, so I'm not sure if you covered this. But you say that there were some stats I just wanted to get some more info on. You say that there's 8,700 parents who would be removed from Medicaid in the first year alone, and that, you know, you give stats that 60% are not in the workforce, 24% describe themselves as unemployed, the remainder are working. Could you give us a little bit of a bigger picture of how many adults are on Medicaid in Alabama right now? How many of them work? Like, what percentage of them work, actually? And how many do you think would be affected? Because there may be, you know, by this waiver, there may be some, as the doctor noted, that may get exemptions for disabled children, or they may be disabled themselves. So if you could just give us a little broader picture of what we're talking about here.
Jim, do you want to kick off on that, and then I can chime in?
Yes, I'll start that. The waiver proposal expressly targets an eligibility group called parents and other caretaker relatives. In Alabama, in order to qualify for Medicaid under that category, a person has to be a parent of a dependent child and has to earn less than 18% of the federal poverty level. For a mom with two kids, for example, that would be earning less than $312 a month. The category on a typical month, that, you know, because enrollment varies from month to month, but in a typical month, that category comprises around 75,000 Alabamians. The projections that Alabama Medicaid provided in the waiver proposal anticipate that in the life of the waiver over 5 years, around 17,000 of those parents will lose their coverage. That leaves 57,000 or so who would either qualify for exemptions or are currently working or would anticipate getting work. So getting work and getting insurance after the employment. So
that's actually a question. You say 17,000 would lose coverage, meaning they would become unemployed or they would just not be on Medicaid anymore?
Well, this, keep in mind, this is a lose-lose proposition for these families. Because we have no virtually no coverage options for people who earn more than the Medicaid eligibility limit up to the federal poverty line or above because we haven't expanded Medicaid. These people lose if they don't comply. That is, if they fail to seek and find employment, they lose their coverage. And then if they do find employment, they very quickly earn their way out of eligibility. So they find the coverage gap as well.
So why wouldn't more people be affected? Is it because they would either be volunteering or job training or exempted? Because as soon as they're working, it sounds like they're going to get kicked off.
I think it's largely the exemptions. We don't know a lot about these projections. We're, you know, for the purposes of citing those numbers, we're taking Medicaid at their own projections, but they haven't provided much detail in the framework of their projections. But we know that a lot of people would be exempted by virtue of, several factors that Medicaid outlines. Another concern we have is that some of the exemptions cited are very clear-cut and easy to track. For example, there's an age exemption for people over age 60. There are exemptions for people who earn SSI benefits, for pregnant mothers, and a few other categories of people who are definitive and would be easy to determine. But there are other exceptional categories that are very vague, and we're concerned that Medicaid may be overestimating those exceptions because they're going to be very difficult to monitor.
And, Tammy, this is Joan. I just want to jump in on this numbers question. One thing that's important to understand is that Jim and I are both using here estimates from their budget neutrality spreadsheet. The state is not saying that many people will lose coverage. But the way they do this in waivers is they do member months. And so essentially we're using their member months and dividing it by 12 to get a number, a hard number of people losing coverage. The reality is, probably a lot more people in this category will be affected and may lose coverage for some period of time. So I would expect this churn, there would be a lot of churn. And so the number itself of folks who would be impacted is probably considerably larger. Like I say, they could lose coverage for 6 months and then maybe get back on. We really don't know, but that's, I think, very troubling. It is not good for parents to be uninsured for any period of time. It also makes it virtually impossible for the state to measure quality. You simply cannot measure quality in your Medicaid program if folks are not continuously covered for 12 months. So we would expect to see certainly some folks losing coverage altogether, but also a lot of these parents to turn on and off in a very unstable situation, a much larger number.
Right. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, Erin, are there any more questions in the queue at this time?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star then one to ask a question, and we'll pause to allow any additional questions to queue.
So while we're waiting for a question to queue up, I wanted to ask Jim a question. You mentioned that this waiver request is not consistent with the mission of Medicaid in your comments. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that and give us some more insights.
Yes, Medicaid is in the business of providing health coverage, not taking health coverage away. And when Congress established the program in the mid-60s, it did so in order to address the critical need for health coverage among needy individuals, low-income families and people considered medically needy with difficult medical situations. And the Alabama proposal, to judge by the projections that Joan just cited in a lower number of member months, meaning essentially a net lower enrollment over the life of this waiver, reveals clearly that the waiver is designed to decrease enrollment, to get people off coverage. It would be one thing if there were other options for those people to get coverage, but we anticipate that those people, for the most part, will just be tossed into what we call the coverage gap, where there are no affordable options. So our view is that that's antithetical to the core mission of the Medicaid program.
Yeah, and this is Joan Alford, Georgetown. I'll just jump in and say that I'm not a lawyer, but I would certainly expect this to move to litigation if it is approved. This is a mandatory coverage group in the Medicaid statute. These parents and, of course, children as well are a required coverage group. So I, again, would expect that we would see litigation if this moves forward.
Okay, Erin. Oh, Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, we need to remember that this waiver targets one of the most vulnerable segments of the population. These are people who are earning extremely low income and caring for children in the home. For these families, health coverage is one of the few assets they have, and this proposal would take that coverage away for a significant segment of that group.
Okay, and it looks like we have one more question in the queue, Erin.
And we'll take a follow-up from Tammy Luby with CNN. Your line is open.
Hi. So actually, Joan, what you just said was really interesting, that it's a mandatory coverage group under the Medicaid statute. So is this one thing that makes Alabama different than Kentucky, Indiana, and Arkansas?
Yeah.
Or do those states also any of the waivers in those states target the mandatory group?
They do include the mandatory group for some of the policies, but they, as you know, have all expanded Medicaid under the ACA. So their coverage levels are much higher, up to 138% of poverty for parents and adults without
mm-hmm.
children. So this class of waivers that we're seeing from Alabama and Mississippi are targeting only this mandatory coverage group. While the expansion group was intended by Congress to be mandatory, as you know, the Supreme Court in Senate mm-hmm. practice rendered that an optional population.
Mm-hmm.
But these parents in Alabama and Mississippi who are targeted are very clearly a mandatory population.
That's right. And I'm sorry, in Kentucky, Indiana, and Arkansas, it's optional. It targets optional and mandatory or just optional?
Yeah. Some of the provisions.
Optional and mandatory.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then is there anything else? Is this the Alabama waiver, is it just consist of these two provisions or are there more? Are there premiums or any other?
It's just these two provisions.
Just these two provisions.
It imposes the work requirement on these parents, and then there's mm-hmm. the rollback of the transitional medical assistance from 12 months to 6 months.
Okay. And when do you expect it to be filed? Because you said it's still for state comment.
So the state comment period, I believe, is up April 2nd. At that time, the state will review the comments and finalize their requests and submit it to the federal government, which also has to have a 30-day comment period before it can be considered.
Mm-hmm.
Mississippi is ahead of Alabama in the queue. We do intend to do a similar analysis of the parents and children affected in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and we have that ready in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But Jim or Marsha, I don't know if you've heard anything definitive from the state in terms of how quickly they intend to turn this around.
I did hear in a meeting with Medicaid officials that they are intending to go full speed ahead. So we anticipate that the timeline will just follow. They'll get, as you mentioned, on April 2nd, they'll have the full range of state-level comments to review, and then
mm-hmm.
we expect that shortly thereafter they'll come forward with a formal proposal to CMS.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. We'll probably follow up on it potentially when they actually when CMS is talking about looking, you know, to approve it or not. But we'll see. We may do a roundup of coverage of states like Alabama and Mississippi where they're not expansion states.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, Tammy, and I'm happy to talk to you offline because I think the reality is CMS has a number of these proposals already before them, and so they could render a judgment pretty soon.
Okay, thank you very much for holding this.
Welcome. It looks like we do not have any other questions in the queue, so I'm going to close and thank our guests for joining us today. And if you have any follow-up questions for Jim Carnes of Alabama Arise, you can reach out to Chris Sanders at 334-832-9060. He's the Communications Director for Alabama Arise. And if you have any follow-up questions for Dr. Rollerson, you can reach out to Jamie Pozlowski of the American Academy of Pediatrics at 202-724-3301. And if you have follow-up questions for Joan Alker, you can reach out to me, Kathy Hope. I'm at 202-687-1058, or you can shoot me an email at katherine.hope@georgetown.edu. We will also have a recording of this call available if you'd like it, probably available sometime later today. And I want to thank you all for joining us.